Welcome back, book nerds. It's Angie, and on today's episode of the podcast, I will be speaking with Jennifer Brody and Jules Rivera, the dynamic duo behind 200, the graphic novel. It's Ava Thorne's 200th birthday, but it's not a celebration, more like a funeral. Ava lives in a world where the cure for aging and illness has been discovered and administered to every person on Earth. Only there's one big hitch. It turns out that very few people can handle immortality. So on their 200th birthday, they have to take a test. If they pass, they get to live forever. But if they fail, they must be euthanized. So, without any further delay, let's jump into the podcast. Hi there, book nerds. Welcome to today's episode of the podcast. Joining us today, we have Jennifer Brody and Jules Rivera. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, hi. Thanks. Thanks for letting me be here, I guess.
And for our audience members who are just getting to know you, can you please introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your work and whatever you like to do for fun? Like, just say hi.
A little fun intro. All right, I'll go first, I guess. I'm Jennifer Brody. I make up stuff for a living. I get paid to nerd. I always like to say that.
That's a good way to put it.
Paid to nerd. I have a young adult but crossover sci-fi trilogy out, the 13th Continuum trilogy. And then I also write a book series for Disney featuring Disney villains haunting kids, kind of Goosebumps meets Disney. That's called Disney Chills. And I write that under the pen name Vera Strange. And I love my creepy pen name. And then I also write graphic novels with my artist, Jules Rivera. And those are, we have two different ones. We have one called Spectre Deep Six that's already out about crazy ghost soldiers, which just got shortlisted for a Stoker Award. And we're here because our new one is about to publish in February, which is what we're chatting about, called 200. And then otherwise, I hang out mostly at home these days with my weird one-eyed golden doodle named Commander Riker, and I live on the beach, so I like to bodyboard and get in the ocean and swim. And I guess that's mostly what I do for fun, besides watch like Mandalorian 400 million times over and over and over. Although I'm into Winx Saga right now.
Oh my God, Winx!
Slutty fairies.
Oh, we are sharing so many dumb jokes about it. I haven't got a chance to get into Winx yet, but that reminds me, I do need something dumb to watch this afternoon while I work. Thanks.
Thanks for that.
I'm thinking slutty butt sex fairies. I'm there. I'm watching it.
It's true. They go to raves. They have pot brownies. It's like Harry Potter meets.
It's basically fairies. Fairies go to high school, but like kind of Harry Potter vibe, you know. I cannot easily be captured in one mere sentence, but if you're gonna try, my name is Jules Rivera. I like to tell people I'm an illustrator because if I say artist, everyone starts saying stupid stuff. Oh, really? You're an artist? Wow, what kind of artist? You draw me as a superhero? No, I can't draw you as a superhero. You can't afford me. I recently took over a long-running comic strip, Mark Trail, and that's been running on the Comics Kingdom website, as well as 175 newspapers across the United States. I know the Pasadena Star carries Mark Trail.
Cool.
Yeah. Whee! Pasadena Star! Yeah, thanks, Pasadena. Love you, too. Mark Trail is basically, it's got started up by Ed Dodd, who actually worked with the guy who set up the Boy Scouts. And he worked with the Scouts of America for his whole career. Mark Trail started 74 years ago, and I got tapped to replace the third of four artists. I'm the number four guy. But before I started with Mark Trail, I was working on these graphic novels with Jen, and I finished up Spectre Deep Six first because I was like, you know what? I'm so confident in myself and my life choices that I'm going to pick the right book to start with, and it's going to make a big splash and get so much money. And then 2020 happened, and I'm like, oh no, I'm stupid. And I realized picking Spectre Deep 6 to start with, I don't know. I finished both of those books. Now you got two flares to pick from. Spectre Deep 6 or 200. Spectre Deep 6, as I like to call it, ghost agents who are literally ghosts, all right? They get time to pay. They get they get killed. The American government's like, I'm not letting you go. I've invested too much money in you, clown. You better get back to work and make me some money. So the ghost gets snatched up from the killing fields and thrown into a spectre suit and right back to work. So it's a really gnarly concept. And when Jen pitched it to me, I was like, what? That's the most insane thing I've ever heard. Of course I'm working on
it. I specialize in crazy ideas.
I mean, I get so, because here's the thing. If you're an artist, you're kind of like the hot girl at prom, right? All these people want to sell you on drawing their idea out because, you know, I'm talented. I can make visuals happen.
That's true.
So, you know, when Jen brought me her idea for Spectrum, I was like, okay, that is definitely something I have not heard before. I get a lot of people throwing Latina action superheroes to me when they're stupid and don't know anything about Latinas and they want advisement from me, but then no, they don't. They're like, I need you to approve of my bad ideas by your presence. And I'm like, you can't afford me. So,
since a running theme, well, Spectre Take 6, though, did get shortlisted for a Stoker, and we are about, I think, to attach a team of directors and move towards trying to make a feature. It's not that nobody loved our little book. A lot of people have loved that.
It came out at such an awkward time, and a lot of the marketing was just, how could you? It was 2020. Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of good things worked in our favor, like the comics market actually got kneecapped by their own foolery with Diamond Distro basically shuttering their doors, and like the whole comics industry came from grinding halt at the very time Spectre Steve 6 got released. So that was interesting. And now we've got 200 coming out.
Which is why we're here to chat.
Exactly. I mean, everything sounds so awesome. And I read a little synopsis of 200. But Jennifer, would you like to tell us a little bit more about it?
Of course. So 200 started as this crazy short story I wrote, the sci-fi short story that did get published. And I just always loved it and thought there was room to expand it into a bigger story. So, which is what we've done with the graphic novel for 200. And it's about a world where there's a cure for aging and illness. So you can live forever, but you're not immortal. You can still get hit by a bus and die. And so everything's going great until people start to hit about 200 years old. And even though the human body is now built for immortality, the mind is not. So people start to lose their minds and something called the rampages start, like murder, suicide, stuff we have now, but worse. And so they study the problem and decide that now when you turn 200, you must take a test. And that test will determine if you have the mental capacity to handle mortality or must be euthanized. So we pick up a woman on her 200th birthday. She was married forever, mostly good ups and downs like normal. But her husband, Owen, was 6 months older. So 6 months ago, the escorts came and took him to his tests and he never came back, which is very normal. Almost nobody passes and almost nobody knows what it means or takes to pass. So she's kind of on a bender. She's drinking. She's chain smoking. She's like, fuck it all. Like, why do I want to live forever if, you know, I'm going to be alone? I've had my time. I know I'm already losing it mentally anyway. I'm totally going to fail this thing. I'm ready to go. I had enough time. And so then on the way to her testing room, she sees someone that works there that looks like her husband. So then the question becomes, did Owen pass his test? Is he still alive? What really happened to him? And the story was originally sort of my love letter to Philip K. Dick. So it's very kind of noirish, twisty sci-fi, but with like kind of our fresh spin on it. And I just knew Jules was like the perfect artist for this. The character is feisty and fun and sweet and crazy all at once. And she's just so great. We loved working with her.
See, but the most important thing about Ava is that I've never been asked this before. And this is another thing why it was a real standout to work with Jen, because she just threw ideas at me that really threw me for a loop. She effectively wanted me to draw me. And because Jen had a very specific idea for the kind of character this person was in her short story. And I read the short story and I was like, wait a minute. Because she was looking for a really kind of salty, worn out woman. You know, somebody who spent a lot of time chain smoking. And you might tell by the sound of my voice, I might spend some time chain smoking, you know? And it was a really interesting, because she found me in kind of I hesitate to say low place, but Jen didn't find me in the greatest of places. I'm just like, I'm all worn out and tired. I'm like, I don't want people to buy my books. Blah. So we found each other at a science sci-fi panel.
Anacon,
Anacon, and we were on a sci-fi panel together. Mm-hmm. And once she saw my really kind of dark, smoky personality, she was like, hey, this is like a character Ava here, because they were recording another artist at the time, and you were like, okay, other artists is gonna get the soft, cute, tender story, you're gonna get the mean, salty girl story. And I was like, this is the correct answer. Yeah, I should get the mean, salty girl story. I've never felt so well suited to a job in my life. and that's exactly what I gave you. I basically carved out me and slung it on a page. And there's a lot of really personal stuff that happens in this book that, you know, these are based on experiences I think both Jen and I experienced in our own ways. So that was another interesting parallel, because we both had similar life experiences that led to the creation of this book.
Yes. And I think if you read, we both wrote things at the end of the book about that. So you can read about our own personal experiences that may be seeping into the story, which makes it extra interesting.
Yeah. That's so awesome. I'm like so excited for this. I have to pre-order it and make sure I read it and shove it in all of my friends' faces, because it just sounds so amazing.
I just want to jump in here. If you pre-order it, you will get the Spectre Deep 6 art book. So if you want extra materials, we can provide a link where you can, you know, if you get that pre-order, we'll give you even more free goodies, because that's what our publisher has been working on setting up. Like, people get free stuff, so be aware of that.
Yeah, and the book's amazing. It's kind of chronicles the design work and all the elements that went into Spectre Deep 6, which was the first graphic novel. And it's a really beautiful book, and Jules did some incredible artwork on that.
And the cover looks amazing. Jules, can you tell us a little bit about the art style we can look forward to seeing?
For 200, yeah, it's so, it stands, the cover just stands out so well.
Well, it's funny. We had a lot of go around with the cover. Like, I had a lot of really kind of stark graphic ideas, and they were just like, can't you just use that thing you used in the pitch? And I was like, what? The thing I drew 5 zillion years ago on a whim? What? Oh, God. Okay, fine. So I updated. It's funny because we went around in a circle in terms of designs, and I found myself just updating the very original pitch document we used. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of zhuzhed it up with the final art style that we decided to go forward with that in the graphic novel. Actually, what makes the graphic novel stand out is all the flowers everywhere. And let me explain how that got there. The flowers were all added in one day at the very end, because I actually didn't know that this thing was going to be covered in flowers when I first started drawing it out. I figured, basic sci-fi geometric things, whatever. But it wasn't until we started talking to Jen McGowan, director. And can I talk about Jen?
We have a film director named Jen McGowan attached, yes. And we're putting together a feature version of it. And Jen is so talented. She directed a film called Rust Creek that I think premiered on Netflix and was trending in the top one or two or three right before the holidays. And if you haven't seen it, it's a really great film. I know everyone's looking for content. So Jen's someone I've known a while and been tracking her career. And so she came on board. So she put a pitch document together, a pitch deck for the film version. And she used a lot of flower imagery in it. And Jules was like, oh my God, the book needs flowers. You're so right. Yeah.
I've been watching Netflix's it's the big flower fight on Netflix, where these artists compete by making these giant flower statues. Kind of like, what if the Pasadena Float Parade, what's the one of them? I don't ever get up early for that one. Anyway, it's like the Rose Bowl parade, but in a competition. And seeing these sculptures, it is intense. Like, these designs are amazing. There's flowers and botanicals everywhere. Like, it was a look like I had never really seen. And I'm like, gosh, I wish I felt bad because I'd drawn out almost the whole book. And I'm like, gosh, I wish I had thrown some flowers in this 200 book. But I'm like, maybe I'll just like keep that to myself, and maybe that doesn't need to be in the book just yet. But then I see Jen McGowan's document, and I'm like, oh my gosh. Oh, and it just really sparked something in me that she was thinking the same thing I was thinking at the same time. And I'm like, nope, I got to cover the whole book in flowers now. So, but I'm really good at making brushes and Clip Studio Paint, and I just made a few flower brushes, and there you go. It's all covered in flowers now. Each of the flowers has little symbolic meanings throughout the book, by the way.
Yeah, and there's a code, I think, you put it in the end of the book where it tells you the significance thematically of each different type of flower that's throughout the book.
That's awesome. I love it. Like, the thought and detail you're putting into it already, I'm just so excited to see it.
It's wild.
But I was going to add on, like, the cover, what got me is the pink. And I didn't know what to expect until, like, I was like, okay, maybe this is, like, maybe, like, a little sci-fi, little girly moment, you know? But when I read the synopsis, I was like, oh, this is not that, you know?
It's not a cute shoujo graphic novel. That is not happening here.
Yeah.
This book's very different. Spectre Deep Six is a full color, kind of more traditional in that sense comic. This one, we wanted to go more stylized, like Sin City, more graphic, like single splash color, lots of black and white. And originally we did this very fluorescent yellow, but this cool thing happens, which is when we seep into Eva's memories of the past, it turns pink. So everything kind of rose or pink when we shift to that color. That's from the past. That's stuff that's in her mind or in her memories. And we love that the design aesthetic of the book is really mimicking the character's journey and what's happening in her internal thought process. It's good stuff.
I'm so excited to like read and see everything. And you can just tell, like, you guys put your heart and soul into this. And I hope everyone who's listening gets to like pre-order it and check it out, because it just sounds like, I can't even explain it. Just, I'm so excited for this. And now that you're saying it's going to be a feature, that's going to be awesome too.
Well, you know, Hollywood is always this long, crazy road and what not, but yeah, we feel optimistic with the finding good partners and hopefully putting together a really neat version of the story. It's always, even as a short story, had a lot of interest from different folks who wanted to make it into a movie or a television show. So we feel confident that with Jen and with our team on board, we can hopefully package it and put it together. We'll see. It's like COVID be happening.
Yeah, we're 2020. So I'm like, what happens now? It's really weird.
Yeah, I think it's going to be another year before things really normalize and regulate in that way is my feeling. But I think hopefully Hollywood people are seeing more of the light at the end of the tunnel, so they'll be more going on this year. I feel like we're all just living in this weird limbo state, you know, at home. Like,
we're definitely in the twilight zone right now.
Yeah, and I just think that's like part of the fun of adjusting. But like the cool thing about having neat stories or neat IP is, you know, that these are sort of evergreen stories and ideas. That's what's cool about sci-fi. So, you know, I think at some point we're going to definitely see this in a different platform, which would be exciting.
And what initially inspired you to tell this story?
This original idea sort of came out of my ex-mother-in-law actually made a comment once where she was like talking about one of her friends like turning older, and she was like, oh, who wants to live that long? Gosh, just put me in a pine box and get rid of me. And I was like, okay. She was like a total character, but I was thinking about it and I was like, yeah, that's actually kind of interesting, because most people would think, you know, I want to live a really long time or forever if I could, but then the real question is, would you really want to if you could? And the answer was like, maybe not. Maybe living forever wouldn't be that great if you really thought about it. And this idea of immortality, you know, has usually been explored, I think, more historically in stories that are like with vampires and things like that, which is different. And I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to explore it more in a science fiction context with something more like a vaccine, like this cure, you know, that is, I tend to take science fiction and try to write very grounded stuff in the sense that the technology might not exist right now, but it is theoretically possible, and we are on the cusp of certain things. Because just even, for example, now, 2021, we live a lot longer than we used to, humans do. The idea that you might be able to extend lifespans is theoretically possible, and there is science and research that's gone into this. So I kind of like taking existing technology or trends and pushing them, and then examining what happens if you change this one thing in the world. And then the idea of, I'm very into taking big sci-fi ideas with lots of bells and whistles and framing them around a very personal story. And so this is clearly framed around the concept of a long-term marriage, you know, and should the relationship continue? What if one spouse was sick and one wasn't? Would you want the other one to outlive you, to have a new life, to remarry? Would you want them to continue, and vice versa? So it's very much an examination of a long-term relationship at the core and the heart of it. Like, that's why I'm obsessed with things like James Cameron. I think he always does a great job by framing these big ideas around very personal stories. I think the best science fiction and horror always does that.
Oh, absolutely. And Jules, was there like a certain moment when Jennifer was telling you about the story, or was there like just like that one instant where you knew you had to work on it?
Well, I mean, it's funny because Jen and I had been talking a lot about eyeballs this morning. Like, there's reasons. Anyway, so we've been talking a lot about eyes and eyeballs. And at a certain point in the story, Jen mentions a character's blue eyes. And just, you know, the manner and the way these characters' blue eyes were, it resonated with me and my experience as well. Jen loves to, you know, be kind about her experiences. I don't. Hi, I'm based on Ava. I mean, Ava's kind of based a little bit off my experiences, and I'm salty, all right? Marriage did not work out for me. I married a fool. All right.
I don't mean to laugh. I'm so sorry.
No, you can laugh. Totally, I can marry. Yeah, I mean, he looked cute, but he was effectively Homer Simpson. And I grew up with a long line of women who settled for clowns because we all took a bad piece of advice of give a nice guy a chance. That's a terrible piece of advice. I will give a nice guy a chance to prove himself worthy. That's how that works. I am a kingmaker. You sit next to me. You're sitting on a throne. You better earn that mess. So anyway, a lot of the thing that I wanted to put in for Ava's experience is a bit of an uncertainty whether or not Owen would feel the same way about her. Because if you're looking at all of her history, a lot of it is kind of from only her perspective. And they, at a certain point in the book, where you see like the blue eyes flash, you know, you start to realize that Ava's perceptions and reality are not necessarily in line. That's all I got to say about that. But how do I put this? But basically, I appreciated how there was a bit of a turnabout, and I was like, I'm in. That's it. I'm in. I got to tell. If anybody's going to tell the story, it's going to be me. So yeah, that for me, like, that's kind of, you know, flip-flopping of perception, that for me was just an important point, because a lot of sci-fi stories are kind of basic. It's just like, alien. Like, why are you making me tell you my alien story? We're living in America for four generations and people still treat me like I've got an alien invader face. You want to tell me your alien story? That's weird. Stop that. You know, but this was a story that told something real interesting and personal. Like, oh, we're talking about some hard stuff. Okay. All right. I'm in.
I love that. And what are your creative processes like? I don't know who wants to take over first, but just, do you listen to music while you're writing creating? Like, is there certain things that get you in that headspace?
Oh, we're such a mess when we're together and collaborating, I mean, especially on Spectre. But we did a bit of collaborating on 200 as well, yeah. Where, you know, if you get us in the same room or thereabouts, because, you know, COVID, more or less, you know, collaborating, and we just do a lot.
I feel like we were in the same room. Yeah, I feel like we were in the same room a lot more with Spectre, but that was before COVID. You're right, and I feel like that was the difference in the process. But I mean, Jules and I kind of text all day every day. Where she's kind of like my work wife.
No, I'm your work husband. You're the wife.
I'm the wife, and yeah, that sounds right. I mean, for Spectre, it was really fun, though, because we would just throw around, like, funny ideas or jokes or lines back and forth, and then, like, you know, the other Jules might have a better take on, oh, we'll try it this way or try it that way. So it is very much, I guess, more akin to like a TV writer's room or something like that, where the books really are heavily a collaboration between the two of us. And I know in a lot of comics and graphic novels, it's very separate. The writer writes, delivers it to the artist just illustrates what's the script, and there's not really that back and forth that Jules and I have. So I think that makes our work and our process a little different than a lot of other writers and artists in this arena that I'm aware of. So I think it also makes the work better. I like collaborating. I like having different ideas and influences come in and seeing where a crazy idea can take you and lead you in story. In terms of the process for us, I don't know. I feel like I procrastinate a lot. I definitely have high functioning ADHD, so that's fun. And I do like music, for sure. I kind of have to kind of get into the story in the zone. And once I'm in the story, I'm really good. Like, I really filter in. I think starting is the hardest part in certain ways. And a lot of times, like, a line will come to me. So I was first writing this short story for 200. The line, I've lived 200 years. I just knew that was like the opening line of the short story. And this is a, I mean, this short story has been through a lot. It was workshopped. First time I went to the 10 House Writers Workshop, I workshopped 200 with Victor Laval, who's one of my favorite writers. And his last book, Changeling, just won the World Fantasy Award. His novella, The Ballad of Black Tom, where he rewrote Lovecraft and took all the racist shit out of it, won the Shirley Jackson Award. And I really believe he's one of the greatest writers writing right now. And this is before Changeling. He was actually in the process of writing Changeling when I was with him. And it was a novel workshop, but I had showed up and I had gotten a deal on my novels. 13th Continuum had sold in a 3-book deal. And it's not like I just had spare novels lying around a workshop. So in a novel workshop, I workshopped a short story, which was 200, saying I might want to expand this one day into a novel. Got all this workshop feedback, all kinds of great ideas, and then took none of them and basically got it published as was. So that's a good lesson. Like, I was like, I appreciate the feedback and I appreciated, you know, hearing what other people thought. But at the end of the day, I had like a vision for what I wanted it to be that I believed in. And that's kind of a good lesson, I think, to writers, which is to say it is good to take feedback. It is good to hear from others. And obviously Jules and I collaborated. So the story became something different. But at the same time, to remember that there was a vision. And obviously you can hear from Jules and I talking about our life experiences, but also the way we approach ideas. There was a lot of synergy in the way we saw this story. And also that we wanted this book to be edgier, to be, you know, more adult. Spectre Deep Six and 200 both sold as trilogy deals. And Spectre is an adult story as well, but it's a little more fun and lighthearted, whereas 200 has, you know, sex, profanity, like,
oh god, you know, I've been telling everyone it's my whole book. Why aren't you buying my slutty home novel? And I've been making it's true. I drew some very important, very nice looking sex scenes in there. I'm very proud of myself. I got into an argument with a friend of mine. Oh no, my new collaborator, Matt Dunford. I'm like, hey, look, this is very high quality sex scenes.
It is. It's tasteful.
Yeah, because he was like, oh, Milo Manara is one of the greatest illustrators. I'm like, Milo Manara is as basic as IKEA furniture. Watch this. So I shoved 200 at him and it made him
believe does draw great stuff. I mean, the thing is, I don't, it's not gratuitous though, because this book meditates on a marriage, on a relationship. And that is a huge component of a marriage and a relationship. So I think it would have been, so it's not gratuitous. It's actually about that. So I think if it wasn't there, it would have done a disservice to the story and the characters. But it was kind of funny because my brother's nephew, his wife's nephew, I think he's like 7, is obsessed with Spectre Deep Six. He's like our biggest fan, MJ. He like sleeps with the book under his pillow. Like, he rereads it and rereads it. And so my brother was like, oh, well, will you send a copy of 200 for MJ? And I was like, yeah, I will. But I just want to warn you that there's adult content in this one, you know. And so you guys should take a look, or even if you need to take some pages out, it's fine with me because he's 7. But and that's so I was laughing.
Just get a Sharpie, kiddo. Just whenever you see the laundromat show up, just bust out your Sharpie and handle it.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, like, I think it's okay for kids to experience these sorts of things. I think it's an interesting double standard in this country that we really want to shelter them from sex, but violence is fine. Like, someone, a movie could have someone murdered 400 million times, or the games they play, right? Like, the first person shooter games, but then, like, there's boobs and everyone's like, oh my God, shield the child from the boobs.
Yeah,
but then I'm kids are basically raised on boobs. Boobs raises them. Like, kids grow up seeing boobs.
Boobs are literally for babies.
Yeah, they're made for babies. Yes, so it's like, I just think it's funny when people and different countries have different thoughts on a lot of this. I feel like we're very puritanical, but I always think it's funny where I'm like, boobs never hurt anyone. Boobs help people. Boobs are good.
Boobs literally nourish the world. Like, mad because you can't control the titties. That's your problem. Yeah, anyway.
I was gonna say, it's bad if a baby doesn't experience that with their mom to a certain level, you know, what baby.
Oh, that's a whole, don't start that argument. I don't want the mommies all up in my face. Like, I have no
way. You have to, but I'm saying, like, what baby isn't, like, around mom's boobs?
I mean, boobs are, what you're saying, boobs are great. They're important.
Yeah, and so that's my thing is that, like, so, but anyway, so that was pretty funny. So this book does have more adult situations in it, but like I said, I think it's very much core to the heart of what the story is. So yeah, there you have it. I don't know. Our creative processes are crazy. And Jules and I are very much both working writers and artists in that we are pretty much always working and juggling 100 different projects and shifting gears and always on different deadlines. So, you know, a day in the life, I don't know. It's like, I wake up and I'm like, what am I working on today?
It's just you take it every day, one day at a time.
Basically.
One day I'll have a normal sleep cycle, I swear.
I think that that's also just pandemic as well. I feel you. Also, I mean, it would be bad anyway, but it does time matter? I was talking to one of my neighbors in the pool and I was like, I thought yesterday was Thursday. And he's like, yeah, last week I thought I was going to the pharmacy on a Wednesday and it was Saturday. And I was like, exactly. Yeah, we're both like, does time mean anything? I don't know.
Literally, like, the concept of time is just like irrelevant at this point. I don't even know what day it is sometimes, and it's just like, it's just another day, honestly.
100%.
And what do you hope the readers take away from reading 200?
Oh wow.
Hopefully some feelings in their genitals. I hope you actually take, there's a very hard lesson you learn at the end, but I hope you take it.
Yeah, it's a very, the ending is very, I want to say bittersweet. Like, I hope it makes you feel something. Yes. Like, I mean, I hope you go on this journey. You know, the twists seem to hit, and people seem to say that they're hitting and working. There are a bunch of twists in the back of the book. And I don't know. I know that I made myself feel things and kind of get kind of teary eyed when I was writing the end of the script. Go ahead. No, I hope that you feel something. And I always hope that these ideas make you think a little bit more about different big ideas. Like, you know, this idea of, would you want to live forever if you could, you know? Yeah. What about you, Jules?
For me, I hope people take away the really hard lesson at the end. I hope that they understand that defund the police, because that's a little thing I got to stitch into the book. Yeah, there's some not awesome cop activity in this book. I mean, it's awesome, but just not in a good way. It's, oh no, scary stuff. So, totally.
And we think the next book's going to meditate a lot more on that.
Oh, it's been, I have so many more ideas. I've actually kind of mentally upgraded them. Like, what if I did this and this and this and this? And this? I'm just kind of like mentally just doing
There's
my
a
notes,
tease
whatever.
At the end of 200 for what we want to do in the next book.
Exactly. Oh. So we can't get too far into that. I honestly hope y'all take away my gnarly lesson. I feel like this book was very hard for me because I had to kind of, in order to draw the romantic fondness scenes, because the problem is I made you know, with the blue eyes of the character, you know, I had to make them look a little familiar to me. So I'm like, great, I have to look at this clown baby again. And I have to remember positive times with this idiot. And I'm like, oh God, this is so hard. I hate this so much. And it was the hardest book I have ever had to draw, but it's over and I don't have to do it again. I don't have to do anything that hard in the next 200. Next 200, I'm gonna have so much more fun. This was a hard book for me to draw. I hope that you get the most important lesson in reading out of it. If not, I've had people review it and say, Ava's got a cute butt. And I'm like, I'll take it.
Anything, any positive feedback, you let Jennifer and Jules know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's always fun hearing from readers. We've gotten some pretty positive stuff from folks on Twitter who have had early reads. So we feel optimistic. I mean, I think the book is definitely a standout and pretty unique, especially compared to a lot of things coming out, which is something Jules and I strive to do, which is to bring kind of different flavor and different types of stories to comics and graphic novel, which is a medium we both love and grew up reading. But I think we're seeing a lot more diversity and different types of stories. And a lot of that comes from having different sorts of creators working in this arena. So it's been fun and very gratifying to kind of take a dive into it.
And I don't want to kind of like just flip the thing like completely, but Jules kind of dived into it about being, you know, a Latina woman in the industry. So I want to ask you guys, what's it like going through all of that? And if you have any advice for other women who want to become an artist, an illustrator, a writer, anything.
Know your worth. Flavor just came into style, all right? People are getting tired of the same old, same old. So yeah, know your worth. Do not settle for jobs that pay you less. You notice how I keep harping on, you can't afford me, because it's true. You should not sell yourself short. I don't know what it's like to go through the industry as a white person, so I can't tell you what my frame of reference is. I'm like, I don't know. I guess that's easier somehow. I don't know. Industry for me, it's an uphill battle to find people who understand my vision and my worth and what I can bring to the table other than advisement on, oh, I have a Latina story as a Latina character. Let me get a Latina artist so that she can draw this out and validate my choices. And, you know, it's good that, you know, Jen welcomed my perspectives on what makes a Latina. Like at a certain point in Spectre Dude 6, there's an argument with two characters. You know, one guy's found out to be like, oh, you're a bad guy. And at a certain point, you know, the Latina woman, she had to like have a reaction. And originally Jen was like, let me write it out. And it's kind of tearful and emotional. I'm like, she's going to get mad. Make her get mad. Like, what did you do, you jerk? I can't believe you, blah, blah, blah. Like, make her get mad. And that kind of experience informs all the little art note pieces going throughout the story, right? So, So I feel like it does get a little tricky because people see my name and they think, oh no, is she gonna murder me? And I'm like, I might. That's a little truth. I'm gonna be real. I'm also the author of a series called Love Jules, in which I am just the meanest person ever.
It's right. A webcomic. It's so fun. I would say, I mean, I'll chime in a little because I did come up through Hollywood too. Yeah. Obviously, I'm in my experience more as a woman or whatever. What I would say is that most of the places where I kind of dip my toe in, and that applies to sci-fi and comics, it's kind of the land of old white dudes. Like, it really kind of is. And I think the issue is what Jules is saying is true, which is I think readers are ready and hungry for this. Some of the gatekeepers aren't quite where they need to be yet. And I think that's the challenge, is getting the people with the pockets, the publishers, the film industry to take more and pay more than just lip service to doing more diversity, which is sort of like, oh, we'll have Catwoman, but let's just make her black. But everyone who's creating this is still white people.
Oh, that was a movie. That movie was a flaming mess. But I ain't gonna lie, I did have that Halloween costume.
Yeah, it's cool. But my point is that
is some whole baggery. I need it.
But it's a good example, or like, I don't know. So, and I think when I first started wanting to write in comics and graphic novels, I already had books published and I was like, well, let me see what this is. And took some meetings. We went to New York Comic Con. I think one publisher even said something to us like, hey, we already have a woman. And we were like, you have a woman. Like, where do you keep her? Like, in the basement. Like, would you like more women? Like, what? Like, you have one. That's great. You know? So I think that kind of says a lot of what we're talking about. And I find in the comic industry, it's fairly myopic, which is to say that they just kind of hire their friends. And it's a lot of mediocre white dudes that just get hired over and over and over.
Because they're too afraid to collaborate with the likes of us, especially me. Because they know I'm going to look at all their ideas and go, yeah, that's dated. Oh, I'm going to hurt their feelings, you know? So I've noticed that I always thrive in environments where there's been a shakeup. Like,
yes, same.
With King Features, there was a bit of a shakeup in the hiring in the last couple of years. And a lot of things have changed. And they wanted a different attitude towards their comics. And that's why I got brought in from Art Trail. because I have a very science-driven attitude. I'm like, oh no, I will teach you the metric system today.
Yeah, and Jules's background is engineering and science.
Oh, yeah.
So, which is another reason why I love collaborating on sci-fi stuff with her. And she brings a lot of that, because I like writing grounded stuff, and she brings a lot of that to the tech and the tech design that we use in the books. But yeah, what Jules is saying, I have found to be true for me too, which is that when there's a shakeup, when there's a change, when there's new leadership, when there's folks who are actually looking for something fresh, tends to be where there's going to be opportunity as opposed to the old guard. And I think that that applies very broadly across industry, most likely. But I do think we need this. Like, we need different types of voices and different types of stories. And, you know, remember, you know, kids come up reading a lot of this stuff that we're writing, you know, and they're hungry for it. And I think it's just really important also to reflect the world we live in. And the world we live in is getting more diverse, not less diverse, especially with the ability of communication, connection. I know travel's been on hold for a little bit now, but it's going to come back. And I see, you know, when I look at like the old Hunger Games, like billboards and stuff, I'm like, oh, it's a bunch of white people. The future's so white. Like, what? Like, and I just think it's bad world building, because I'm like, well, did we have an ethnic cleansing between now and then?
Yeah.
No, I'm just saying you could adjust for it in your world build, but like, what happened? Because when I look at the world now, it doesn't look like that. So what does the future look like? Well, I think it's going the other way. If I'm looking at the future, this is world building stuff, you know. So when I look at that kind of stuff, it feels really dated to me, because it doesn't look like the world should
also
look like.
What kind of fantasy are you trying to say where you fantasize about a world with no brown people in it, huh?
I agree, and that's what brings me to we can come back to Wink Saga now. Thank you, Wink Saga.
Okay, well, what about how does it tie back to Wink Saga now?
Yeah, there's gay people in it. There's people of color. Of course there are. And it's like, you know, and that's what I'm saying, is that you can compare that. And I'm not going to get into a whole thing, because I do love Harry Potter for certain reasons. But, you know, it's like you can compare. Right? You know, we know it's going. But like, yeah. And so Wink Saga, which does have some Harry Potter flavor, probably part of why I like it. But if you just even look at what they did with the casting and the writing, it's definitely more up to date. So anyways, that's my little spiel on that.
it's modern, but actual, like, legit Winx fans of the original children's series that came out in the early 2000s. Oh, those guys are mad. They're like, this is nothing like my TV show. What is happening? Blah.
I know.
And like, all the 35-year-old guys online are losing their marbles.
I know, over this kid's cartoon. But I'm like, what did you think they were going to do? It is funny. I have seen that too. They are upset about it. Whereas I'm all for it. I'm like, heck yeah, let's do this.
I was already in college when that cartoon came out, so I wasn't really attached to it. But I was like, you know, when I see the Winx Club now, I'm like, okay, this is not that cartoon. I will agree. But it can be an interesting thing in its own right. That's my approach to it.
I agree with you.
And that's the thing with a lot of media that's being like rebooted or something. Everyone wants it to stay the same, but that's not what we need.
Yeah, that's a good
way
to put it.
We need it to adapt.
Sorry, 35-year-old guys.
It would be like a kid's show. And it was already a cartoon. And I always say the cartoon lives in its own space, but they wanted to do something different and more modern. And all I know is I'm here for it. It is really fun watching.
I have yet to check it out, but it seems really interesting. I've only seen the negative comments, but I'm just like, well, I'm going to have to watch it for myself. It looks like a fun show. It's just, you know, it's not made to cater to the exact same audience anymore, you know?
Exactly. The audience is shifting, and I think a lot of people are having a lot of a hard time, you know, accepting change. And change is hard. It's true.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to jump into a new segment we're going to have on the podcast. Some of our listeners and my followers have some questions for you guys. And
awesome.
Kendalyn would like to know, how do you get out of your creative blocks?
Oh gosh. What do we do, Jules? Do we want the PG version?
I let everyone know I'm going to be a couple days late. That's how. It's been really hard trying to create in the middle of a pandemic, capital apocalypse, cray cray foo foo mess. gosh, how do I overcome creative blocks? Well, it's not even that it's creative blocks. It's just the rest of the world is so chaotic that you're like, I guess I'm going to have to put in an order for a Switch and get some Animal Crossing in my life.
No, Jules is totally right. I think it's not, Jules and I are both the types of creators with 100 million ideas, 100 million projects. And we, I don't want to speak for Jules entirely, but we kind of, I think, thrive on our work. It's really our passion. It's something we're very into. I did it before I was even paid for it. I am paid for it now, but I would still probably do it just because I love creating. But this environment has absolutely been the most challenging. I always say we're living through the Hunger Games meets I Am Legend. Like, we're in the middle of two giant crises, like, at the same time, like political crisis meets, like, you know, contagion crisis. And the noise of the world, I just feel, got turned up so loud. And usually people like us are sensitive to those vibrations. And even harder, when you're writing science fiction, you're reacting. It's really not about the future. It's really about the present. And so I've even had, like, the book I'm revising now is, like, about Space Force, but I was writing it before Trump created Space Force. So you're writing this stuff in this, like, shifting environment. And you're trying to respond. Like, Jules even pointed out in 200, which is a story I mentioned I wrote a while ago, that medical face masks play a huge role in the plot of the story. And she was like,
I was drawing the thing out. And I'm like, Jen, what is this? Why everyone's wearing face masks on TV, but it's in the script. Why am I drawing the news, Jen? It was wild.
It was like, she was like, how did you know this was what was going to be? And I was like, I didn't. I don't know. It's weird. Like, I didn't know. But, like, in the future of this book, they're wearing these medical masks through a lot of story. And I know a lot of folks who read it are going to be like, oh, you wrote this because of the pandemic. But it's actually, and you can go back to my short story, which is published in the back of the book. It's in the story. It's in the short story.
Literally in the short story. And just for the record, I was drawing this thing because we established what the script is way before I ever start drawing the book, because I don't believe in, oh, moseying around and making artwork until I find a story. Heck no, I am structured AF. I need an engine, you know, yeah, it's an engineer mindset where, okay, the script is done. We would make the script, push it out. Like, it was already pretty much done by December. So, and I think, like, we did some last, I did some, like, filler writing in, like, maybe January, but the script was done before all of coronavirus ever started. So that was the wild thing for me. Like, wait a minute, why are we drawing the things we just wrote out? This is insane.
Yes, I think, you know, I would say, like, even on my last Disney deadline for the fifth book in my Disney series, it was, I would say, the hardest time I've ever had getting myself to actually write. And I did make my deadline, but I have never struggled so much. And I think that was at the height of the election, all the uncertainty, the second lockdown. And I think what it is that there's just so much of that invading your daily life that it can be challenging. So I would say to try to overcome it, honestly, is try to get in my own weird little bubble. So things like rewatching Mandalorian 400 million times is, like, my happy place. Harry Potter happens to be my happy place. Winx Club, current happy place. I did just get a Nintendo Switch. I love Mario. I love Zelda. But just doing things, walking on the beach, being with my dog, just trying to insulate a little bit and get into that weird creative space where I can actually find joy and work, because I think we're not alone. A lot of creatives have been writing about this, where, oh, I thought I'd have so much time at home and I'd be so productive, but no, you're in the middle of, like, a international crisis and mourning, and it's a very difficult time. I think everyone to some degree is just trying to survive and get through, and everyone has different struggles and burdens with that. Jules and I are both single women who live alone, if it's okay for me to say that. Jules can speak for herself.
I mean, I'm the most dangerous thing on my block, whatever, but no, I'm the most dangerous thing on my block that still wears masks. Anyway.
Well, that's a challenge. Well, it's just even little things like leaving your house worried if people are being safe, if they're wearing masks in your neighborhood. It's just, you know, everyone has, I think, challenges right now. So, but I would say, yeah.
Yeah, but I just bought the coolest cyberpunk face mask. So I actually feel a lot better about that now. It's just, I mean, for me, I'm just trying to do my artwork, and I'm looking up, you know, all the news feeds and stuff, and I'm going, is the government going to explode? Yay! Make my plans to run away from America. Is this going to be a problem? I mean, what? Yes. I'm just going through these thoughts. There's not a lot of room for, gosh, am I drawing this building in perspective? Like, your priorities kind of shift around, you know? Like, what do I do to not explode?
Yeah, it's like how, yeah. And I think that that's been the extra challenge. But I would say for your reader or listener that, you know, find things that bring you joy, like, or inspire you, like listen to music, like read a book, even if you've already read it before, from a writer that you love or admire, like get outside, walk around, you know, change your scenery if it's possible, and just try to rediscover I think, you know, it was Jonathan Mayberry who said this to me. He was one of my favorite writers and a huge mentor and inspiration, and wrote a great blurb for 200. He's a really famous author.
You did a good job. Like, thanks, Jonathan.
No, his blurb was great. He loves our work. He reads all my books. But he said, when I was struggling one day, he said, just remember why you wanted to write in the first place. Like, remember what it was that made you want to do this. Like, go back. And I was like, gosh, that's true. Like, the very core of what it is that made you want this. And I just thought that was nice to remember why you want to create, why you want to be a writer, an artist, or whatever your passion is. So great question, though. Great question.
And she also asked if you have any advice for aspiring writers.
Oh, yeah. Writers, aspiring writer advice. Well, there's different types of writing, but if you want to do the kinds of things I do, read as much as you can. I know everyone says that, but, you know, always have good sentences in your ears. You don't necessarily have to read even the same kinds of things and stories that you want to write. Identify what type of thing you want to write. You know, is it sci-fi? Is it fantasy? Start incubating ideas. Seek out your community, which, I mean, you know, other writers, and there's a lot of stuff virtually. There's tons of Facebook groups. I run an author's group called Book Pod. And when you're ready, I really recommend taking writing classes or writing workshops. I teach novel workshops for the Writing Pad in LA, which are 5-week, kind of 3-hour a piece, like intro to novel, and I teach a novel too as well. But, you know, seek out some craft instruction or just other writers where you can workshop and start to share your stuff, because that starts to help you get better. Because it is, yes, there's a talent component, but it's a craft, and there's a lot of craft-based stuff that you can absolutely learn and improve. And, you know, get these other influences. So it's kind of like find your tribe. When I first started writing, I never took classes, and I don't have an MFA, but I did at a certain point seek out things like the 10 House Writers Workshop, the Sirenland Writers Conference. I did a residency at the Banff Center, just different places where I could go. And there was a bit of an investment of money, or a little bit of money, although a lot of them do offer scholarships. But I find that, you know, money is a tool. So investing a little bit in yourself, and that could even just be getting a computer to write on, whatever the things you need to invest in, signals intention, and it can help get you set up to do work, or to really kind of thrive in it. And when I started investing in that, a lot of things started happening for me. So I guess that's my 2 cents. Jules, do you have anything to say about it?
Writing advice.
Because you write as well.
It's true. I am a writer, so I'm thinking about, because I've been thinking, as you've been talking, I'm like, what's a smart thing to say about writing? I would say start and don't stop. Don't let other people try to tell you who to be, because
that's a good one.
In my case, it took me a really long time to, I guess, find my voice and find what is the best way to channel my energies in a way that just really hits people where they live.
I relate to that.
You know, kind of developing your, I guess, personality as a writer.
And voice.
Is important.
Yeah, your voice.
And your voice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but voice is an awkward word, because voice, I think, is like personality as a writer is not just how you are towards people, but how you inflect the writing with your personality. Like for me, you read anything that I wrote? Okay, first of all, you might have noticed I'm the jokes punch up writer here between the two of us. So
yeah,
we will write jokes, but then like Jen will write a joke, but I'm like, let's evolve it upward. And like, you know, I bring a lot of the humor to this. Usually the meaner, saltier stuff that comes up, that's probably me. Jen's so soft and sweet. That's not true. She's actually quite mean to a lot of our specters, but sometimes, but she's still very tender about it. Like, oh, I feel so bad. I have to destroy your dreams. And I'm like, oh, that's messed up. I would say, yeah, but, oh, and this is just a practical thing. In a graphic novel, when you're doing dialogue, less is more. Hi, walls of text. You are not Chris Claremont. Put the pen down. And that's an X-Men joke, because in X-Men comics from like the early 90s, Chris Claremont would write these long, winding paragraphs and have them in fight scenes. And I'm like, what are you doing? Who has the time to have all the speechifying in the middle of a fight? Mm-hmm. So I love his work, but there's a lot of walls of text. So be mindful of the fact that your reader experience is going to get affected if you throw a bunch of walls of text. So if you're learning to write graphic novels, learn to talk less. That was the very first lesson I had to learn as a graphic novel writer.
It's good advice.
This is amazing advice. And David would like to know, Jules, how do you decide on your panel layout?
Oh, that's an excellent question. Okay, so fun fact that I forgot to mention, one of the many things I do to earn money is I'm also an educator. I work at Cal Lutheran, California Lutheran University, as a storyboard instructor. And
Jules and I both teach, which I think is really cool.
Well, I believe in educating the world upward. Like, same. We're in a foolery because there's been a dearth of education, you know, a lot of cuts to the funding of educational programs, both in the arts and the sciences. So I'm going to fix that. I'm like, you will get absolutely educated. I mean, that's why I'm Mark Trell's dad. So as a storyboard instructor, you learn, or I've learned anyway, because what I've had to do is teach storyboards to students who are not necessarily artists, because it's in the communications department. Mm-hmm. So I've learned that when teaching storyboards, figuring out what kind of an emotional feeling you want per panel kind of matters in terms of character placement. And I mean, it's a lot to get into here, but character placement, what kind of just emotional note am I going through at that moment where I say, okay, this character, we've got a wide shot. We need to establish that this character is very lost in the wilderness or very, you know, alone. So we'll draw them as one little dot in the middle of a big, vast whatever. Right? It's just manipulating people's emotions through a story by just pictures, which you can do. Oh, heck yeah. Like I said, I wrote my own textbook for the university because nobody had written a textbook to the lessons that I really needed to teach these students. So I just wrote my own. I'm like, I don't want to have to think about what I'm going to teach before class. I'll just write a textbook and save myself the time. So yeah, that's all covered in my textbook, Emotional Currency. And I just offered as like a $10 PDF, whatever. I'll probably just cut it to like $5. Who cares? But basically, yeah, the lessons that I've learned in trying to convey how to do storyboards for people who don't know how to make artwork are the lessons that go into all of the framing and the artwork that I do now. But it basically keep it simple and basic, but using these shapes and these glyphs and these colors for great purpose is how these emotional stories hit.
Emotions, yeah, and I love everything. How the panels really affect the character's journey, like in 200, the way they start to fragment the further we get kind of into Ava's psyche. Jules is, and I think some of the reviews have even commented on how excellent her panel designs are. So she's great. She's also great at action sequences. Jules does great.
Oh, if things are flying around or running around or exploding, I'm about that life. I also surf, so, and not body surf, like surf. So that's another thing. And I'm very crazy about that. I'm a very physical person. So I like to reflect that physicality in the action sequences that I show. I want you to feel that punch if the character gets hit, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I need you to feel the stuff. So yeah, that's another thing in developing your personality or your point of view. Surfing matters. Surfing really affected how I tell stories, how I design characters. Mainly just because my relationship to the ocean, what kind of wetsuits I wear, etc. So developing yourself means developing yourself as a human, and that goes into your writing.
Yeah, it all, like, in the end, it all comes down to you. And I think that's just like, I think that's one of the good things about the chaos we're in right now, is that a lot of people are able to kind of take that time to figure out who they are, what they enjoy, and just, you know, all those little things that in our, you know, back when it was, everything was normal, so to say, we didn't really have much time to think about. We were just kind of just doing tasks and going from one task to another, and yeah.
Absolutely.
Like, I don't even know how to wrap that up. It was just like, we were just kind of just everywhere, and now we kind of have that time to sit down and reflect and take all of that in.
That's very true.
And he would also like to know, Jules, if there's a certain program you like to use, or do you prefer, you know, traditional materials? Like,
what's the best way? I don't have time to mess with a scanner right now. So yeah, everything I do is digital. The program that I use to get to most of his artwork started is something called Clip Studio Paint. It's basically a comic making software. And it's dirt cheap. You can find it. They're always having a sale. Go grab that. It's also pretty comparable to Photoshop. Although Photoshop, I like for the special effects that went into Spectre. So 200, I don't think I actually saw Photoshop, but Spectre does because of all the, because the special effects are just a different animal with Spectre. I wanted each of these books to have their own separate look, their own identity. So I feel like for painting and coloring stuff, I love Photoshop. I just can't get the stupid Clip Studio paint brushes to do what I want them to do. And I already know how to do it in Photoshop, and I'm not retraining myself. So yeah, that's the software I like to use. But never underestimate the power of just sketching your ideas out on paper. The messier and stupider, the better. Because I think a lot of people focus really hard on making things perfect and making sure it looks great. No, better is done than perfect. I mean, done is better than perfect. So it is important to, kind of loosen up and just let go and let flow. You know, because I think people get tied up in trying to make a perfect product on their first go around. And I'm like, just make peace that it'll suck. Okay, it's fine. You can always improve. All right.
That's great advice for writing too.
You never want your first book to be your best one. That's a bad writing career.
Oh no, definitely. Because once you have something good, people just want something even better.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you're Stephen King walking around saying, why does everyone think The Stand is my best book? I like to think I got better, and it wasn't my second book, wasn't my best, but everyone thinks it's The Stand.
Yeah. I mean, you guys are giving amazing advice, and I love talking to you both. And where can we keep up with you? Because you both are a force to be reckoned with, and I'd love to follow you on social media, and I'm sure our listeners would too.
Well, I am at Jennifer Brody, just my name on Twitter. And then on Instagram, I'm Jennifer Brody Writer, and I'm probably the most active there. I'm also Facebook, Jennifer Brody Writer. And my website is just jenniferbrody.com. So yeah, those are good places to find me. What about you, Jules?
Okay, on Twitter, I'm at Jules Rivera. On Instagram, I'm love.jules, because that's the name of my webcomic. But you'll get to see like all of the above. Basically all of my artwork for 200, for Spectre, for sometimes my dumb TikTok videos, because I feel like TikTok is kind of the way of the future for me.
TikTok is just insane.
Yeah, it's easy filmmaking that can happen in like barely a couple of minutes. Like, I believe it's revolutionary.
And oh, I agree.
It's also been showcasing talent that we would have never really seen before TikTok, because YouTube was just kind of a different animal, where people kind of expected longer videos and stuff. Where TikTok, it just keeps you to either 15 seconds or your 60 seconds, and you figure it out. Yeah. But yeah, I'm really excited to see all these young people and with their amazing talent coming out of there. Just amazing.
I'm on same boat with you on all of that.
Kids are all right. I love it.
Same.
Thank you both so much for joining me today. I can't wait to read 200, and I hope everyone listening in was able to, you know, relate to at least one aspect of the story and are able to check it out and also take along some of that amazing advice that you gave us. And yeah, just thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us and letting us talk about our crazy little sci-fi adventure book. Hopefully we'll talk to you again sometime. Thanks again.
Yeah. Most agreed.
Had a great time talking to Jennifer and Jules, and I hope you all had fun listening in. 200, the graphic novel, is being released February 16th, so make sure to grab your copy at turnerpublishing.com. Thank you for listening in. Take it home for us, Jennifer and Jules.
Hi, this is Jennifer Brody, author.
And Jules Rivera, artist.
Of graphic novels, books, comics, you name it. And we're here talking to you on GeneBookNerd.com.
It's GeneBookNerd.com, son!